a racist and neo-imperialist tool. It's never been about controlling substances that are dangerous for communities. And the arrest of Cienfuegos is just one more example of how the highest level federal officials in charge of supposedly policing the drug industry are the ones actually administering it. This goes back all the way to the 90s with General Jesus Gutierrez Rebollo, Noe Ramirez Mandujano in the Calderon administration, of course, Garcia Luna, and now Cienfuegos. The United States is obsessed with controlling and perpetuating this drug war, which wreaks terror on communities. Connecting it to migration, I was in the Central Valley, California. Migrants that are fleeing situations of terror that are provoked by the U.S. drug war.
We want to thank you both for being with us, John Gibler and Anabel Hernandez. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask, vote. Happy.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
In the 1980s, Portland, Oregon was a sleepy city that largely existed outside of the national spotlight.
Downtown Portland cleared out after 5 p.m. and city buses rolled through quiet streets populated by hobos, punks, drunks, drug dealers, and street kids. Some of these kids were targeted by white nationalists and became neo-Nazi skinheads.
Late one night in 1988, Mulugeta Sarah was beaten with a baseball bat and left for dead.
Three white kids who killed Sarah weren't outside agitators, but members of Eastside White Pride, a neo-Nazi street gang.
By the mid-90s, racist skinheads had disappeared from the streets of Portland. How did this happen?
It Did Happen Here is a documentary podcast that chronicles how immigrants, civil rights activists, and militant youth worked together with the diversity of tactics to drive white supremacist street gangs out of Portland.
The first episode will be released November 13th, the 32nd anniversary of the murder of Mulugeta Sarah.
Stay tuned.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, COVID-19 is on the rise in many states across the country. Environmental groups are suing the federal government for its use of chemical weapons on Portlanders. And in international news, Nigerian police forces opened fire on protesters yesterday, killing at least 12 people. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 21st, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. The latest case counts of the coronavirus show an alarming growth rate in the United States. The New York Times reported an average of over 60,000 cases per day over the last week. This is an increase of 36% from the average we saw 2 weeks earlier. As of mid-October, average death counts in the country were around 700 per day, which the New York Times says is far more than were reported in early July. Most states in the U.S. are showing an upward trend of daily reported cases. The states seeing the highest reported cases per 100,000 residents in the last week were North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Wisconsin, and Nebraska. Rising case counts come shortly after President Trump recovered from the virus himself and has referred to the country's health officials as, quote, idiots. In an interview with CNBC on Monday, the country's leading health official, Dr. Fauci, reiterated the importance of five fundamental things for all to follow: universal wearing of masks, maintaining physical distance, avoiding congregate settings or crowds, doing things outdoors as opposed to indoors, and washing hands frequently. When asked about this fall and winter, Dr. Fauci said the country is, quote, facing a whole lot of trouble if masks aren't worn or safety precautions aren't heeded. In Oregon, there have been an average of 337 cases per day over the past week, an increase of 15% from the average 2 weeks previous. As of Wednesday afternoon, there have been at least 40,264 cases and 638 deaths in Oregon since the beginning of the pandemic. The ACLU Foundation of Oregon sued the Department of Homeland Security and Acting Secretary Chad Wolf on behalf of a coalition of environmental groups who are concerned about the use of chemical weapons against Portlanders. The suit says the indiscriminate use of, quote, an arsenal of weapons during Operation Diligent Valor violated the National Environmental Policy Act. The ACLU suit emphasizes the damage to human life and the environment caused by weapons such as CS gas, pepper spray, and hexachloroethane, or HC smoke grenade. People exposed to these chemical weapons report weight loss, menstrual irregularities, lung damage, exhaustion, and a host of other symptoms. CS gas, which is commonly referred to as tear gas, is banned in international warfare, meaning it is a war crime to use the substance on enemy forces or civilians abroad. HC smoke grenades contain zinc chloride and are known to cause liver, kidney, and nervous system damage. Both weapons severely impact the lungs. They are also believed to cause cancer. Due to the fine particulate nature of these chemical weapons, they spread out and affect more than just the targeted individual or group. Following demonstrations, canisters and chemical powder runoff end up in storm drains, leading directly to the Willamette River. Protesters come home covered in toxic chemicals, sharing tutorials on how to safely wash their clothes and skin on Twitter. While Mayor Ted Wheeler banned the use of CS gas by the Portland Police Bureau in September, the chemical is still being deployed in Portland neighborhoods by other agencies, including federal agents guarding the ICE facility. Last week, a resident of an apartment building near ICE was sent to the hospital after inhaling tear gas in their own home. The suit calls for the immediate end to the use of these weapons until a full environmental impact study can be done. In the suit, the ACLU is representing the Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides, Willamette Riverkeeper, Cascadia Wildlands, Neighbors for Clean Air, and 350 PDX in the lawsuit. The Department of Homeland Security has refused to comment. A press release by Indy Namkung from 350 PDX read, quote, "The price of justice shouldn't be further harm to public health and to the Black, Indigenous, and other people of color who are already out here fighting for their lives. Everyone has a right to know the impacts of the toxic chemicals we're being subjected to by our government." Edie Mondenay submitted his resignation as president of Portland's chapter of the NAACP on Tuesday morning. The move comes a week after reporting from the Portland Mercury exposed allegations that Mondenay sexually assaulted three men who were members of Celebration Tabernacle and psychologically abused another eight people connected to the church. Mondenay founded and served as pastor of Kenton's Celebration Tabernacle for 32 years. He has denied all accusations, saying in a Facebook livestream last week that they were, quote, "a manifestation of the current trend of cancel culture." The Portland NAACP board voted 7-3 on Friday, calling for Mondenay's immediate resignation. Sources on the board told the Mercury Mondenay refused to step down at that time, though he did withdraw his name from the re-election in November. Over the past year, an accountability group called Rise Up PDX has been documenting financial and bylaw abuses by the chapter's president. There were also reports that Mondenay threatened physical violence at a chapter meeting last year. It was the NAACP investigations that led to Mondenay's accusers coming forward. Rise Up PDX has been pressing for a change in leadership and promoting candidates for the November 21st election. The NAACP says it received Mondenay's resignation on Tuesday. Celebration Tabernacle has not made an official statement regarding Mondenay's leadership or the accusations, though he is still listed as a senior pastor and apostle on the church's website. Multnomah County Commissioner Sharon Myron has raised an idea discussed in the past, having the Portland Police Bureau put under the control of the Sheriff's Office. Last week, at a meeting before the county's local Public Safety Coordinating Council, Myron said, In the context of deep community safety systems reform, it's time to seriously consider dissolving PPB and potentially bringing the work of law enforcement to the county, which has a much broader, integrated, upstream, and holistic approach towards public health, safety, and justice. The county already controls the budget for the sheriff's office, the jails, and the district attorney's office, as well as providing social services for affected populations. The Multnomah County Sheriff is an elected position currently held by Michael Reese. Mayor Ted Wheeler is also Portland Police Commissioner. Wheeler said that he remains, quote, intrigued by the idea and that, quote, Myron and I have spoken a number of times about how we can better align systems between Multnomah County and the City of Portland. Daryl Turner, the president of the Portland Police Association, said there are many obstacles to this change, including the two groups of officers being in separate unions, and the Portland Police having many levels of oversight that the sheriff's office doesn't. Millions of acres of the Tongass National Forest would be open for logging and other destructive development if the Trump administration lifts roadless rural protections. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. Southeast Alaska tribes are loudly protesting the Trump administration's move to strip the Tongass National Forest of roadless rural protections. As Jacob Resnick reports, the tribes say their input was ignored by the U.S. Forest Service.
The rule restricts, though does not prohibit, road building and resource development on some national forest lands. Critics say that locks up natural resources. But to change it, the federal government is required to consult with tribal governments. And it did. 9 Southeast Alaska tribes in all, whose traditional homelands are now part of the country's largest national forest.
The Tongass, which we sit in the middle of, is part and parcel of being Tlingit. We are a people of the land.
Bob Starbard is administrator of Hoona Indian Association. When the federal government started their consultation, the tribe was the first to sign on as a cooperating agency. And he says at first, it seemed like the Forest Service was listening.
It became clear at the very end, however, that the game had already been fixed.
By that, he means the meetings, hearings, and public comment periods dominated by Alaskans in favor of keeping the rule intact didn't move the agency. It recommended lifting the rule completely and is expected to make it official before the end of the month.
It's just another broken promises to tribes, as far as we're concerned.
The 9 tribes said as much in an October 13th letter to the Trump administration. The 3-page letter is unequivocal, with one sentence in boldface: "We refuse to endow legitimacy upon a process that has disregarded our input at every turn."
For National Native News, I'm Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Alaska.
In North Dakota, the Standing Rock Sioux and other tribes are once again trying to stop the flow of oil in the Dakota Access Pipeline. The Bismarck Tribune reported the tribes were successful earlier this year when a U.S. district judge ordered the pipeline closed down until the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers conducted a more extensive environmental review. But an appeals court overturned that order in August. The tribes are asking the judge to clarify his ruling to satisfy the appeals court and once again order the pipeline to stop operating. The tribes argue that the pipeline threatens their water supply. The Corps of Engineers wrapped up a public meeting last week on the environmental study it was ordered to conduct. The study will gauge whether the agency must reissue an easement for the pipeline's Missouri River crossing in a reservoir near the Standing Rock Reservation. The deadline for comments on the environmental study is October 26th. But the Standing Rock Sioux filed a request to extend the deadline. The Corps and the pipeline's operator, Energy Transfer Partners, have until November 20th to file a response. In Michigan, the Bay Mills Indian community submitted formal comments as part of ongoing efforts to stop a pipeline tunnel underneath the Straits of Mackinac connecting Lakes Michigan and Huron. WPBN reports the tribe sees the pipeline by energy giant Enbridge as an existential threat to treaty rights and an environmental danger to 3 of the 5 Great Lakes. It's asking the state to reject the company's permits under the Clean Water Act and Michigan's Natural Resources and Protection Act. An administrative law judge in August granted the Bay Mills Indian community the right to intervene in the pipeline fight. It's the first time a tribal nation has intervened in a proceeding before the Michigan Public Service Commission. In Colombia, thousands of indigenous people converged on the country's capital, Bogota, after traveling hundreds of miles to demand a meeting with President Iván Duque. The BBC reports he refused to meet with them. They're seeking an end to the violence escalating in their territories and consultation on major development projects. The southern part of the country has a large indigenous population and has seen at least 42 massacres this year, according to the United Nations. Activists say indigenous leaders are being systematically killed. The protesters are planning to join a national strike on Wednesday. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
Nigerian police forces opened fire on protesters Tuesday night in the city of Lagos. KBU's Nat Moon has more on the story.
Nigerian police forces opened fire on protesters against police brutality Tuesday night in the nation's largest city of Lagos. Tens of thousands of people have been demonstrating for weeks against the country's notoriously brutal and corrupt police agency, the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, known as SARS. Yesterday, police fired live rounds on protesters, killing at least 12 and injuring countless more. Originally created in 1984, SARS is a special unit meant to respond to violent crime like robberies, carjackings, and kidnappings. However, SARS later evolved into the same problem it was created to stop, a criminal enterprise acting with impunity. Amnesty International released a report documenting at least 82 cases of torture, ill treatment, and extrajudicial executions by SARS officers since January 2017. Amnesty said the Nigerian government's unwillingness to address the problem shows, quote, an absolute disregard for international human rights laws. The catalyst for recent demonstrations against police brutality appears to be a video from October 3rd showing the unprovoked killing of a man by SARS officers. Nigerian officials claimed the video was fake and arrested the individual responsible for filming it. A week later, the Inspector General of Police, Mohamed Adamu, announced SARS would be disbanded, the fifth time the police have claimed SARS would be reformed or disbanded in the last 5 years. Many credit the recent uprising to youth in the nation who are, quote, rediscovering their power. They have renamed themselves the, quote, Speak Up Generation. Over half the country's population is under the age of 19. As we've seen across the United States and in other countries around the world, young people are turning out in huge numbers and mobilizing on social media to raise funds for mutual aid, such as food, water, and raincoats for those on the front lines. Reporting for KBU, I'm Nat Moon.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBU Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBU membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30 for KBU News In Depth, where Don Merrill will be interviewing Republican Secretary of State candidate Kim Thatcher. And at 5:45, we'll hear news from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBU. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising, then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 36 degrees, and tomorrow we can expect mostly sunny skies with a high of 58. Today in history, in 1956, actor Carrie Fisher was born. Best known for playing Princess Leia in the Star Wars film, she also spoke candidly about her drug addiction and mental health. The quote of the day is from Carrie Fisher, who said, quote, "Resentment is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die." For KBU News poet Dan Raphael, it's time to rhyme.
2 weeks from today, what will I say? We may not yet know if it's Donnie or Joe, if the future holds hope or depression and woe. I want a landslide, an undeniable victory, not days or weeks of uncertainty with flares of violence and insanity. Joe will be calm while Donnie rages, having tantrums like someone one-tenth his age. It will take more than Biden to get back on track, assuming the Dems take the Senate back, and the old normal we yearn for was seriously flawed as global war warning and pandemics threaten us all. Capitalism must be reined to stop spoiling the land. So many ready to pitch in and plan for a thriving world, a world starting to heal. And I'm talking about more than the new Green Deal. People must change, see we're all connected. In a healthy ecology, no parts are neglected. Racial justice, economic justice, equality for all. Let this election uncork what's been brewing for years. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
After doing nearly nothing to slow the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett, Democrats weigh boycotting the committee vote on Trump's Supreme Court nominee. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Judge Barrett's well-known stances on marriage equality, trans equality, and other issues represent a serious risk to our civil rights.
That's Jim Obergefell, plaintiff in the landmark Obergefell versus Hodges Supreme Court case that cleared the way for same-sex marriage in 2015. Yesterday, he joined the defendant, Rick Hodges, a lifelong Republican, to oppose the Supreme Court confirmation of Trump nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett ahead of the GOP-led Senate Judiciary Committee vote tomorrow, with a full Senate vote expected soon after. Here's Hodges.
I, along with 70% of Americans, fully support marriage equality.
It's one of a number of issues civil rights groups are concerned about if Barrett is confirmed, making a 6-3 conservative majority. Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito recently signaled that they would like to overturn the Obergefell ruling. Some GOP senators are proposing a constitutional amendment to limit the number of justices on the Supreme Court to 9, saying they're barring so-called court packing. Law professor Brian Leiter at University of Chicago says the GOP has already packed the court.
When they denied Merrick Garland even a hearing, President Obama's nominee, they were violating longstanding norms governing appointments to the Supreme Court in order to gain partisan advantage.
Senate Democrats are weighing boycotting Thursday's committee vote, forcing Republicans to either postpone or break committee rules that require Democrats there for official business. President Trump and his allies charge, without basis, that former VP Joe Biden and Senator Kamala Harris plan to add more justices. Biden says he'll make his position known before November 3rd.
Trump and Pence, when they talk about packing the court, they've already packed the court, so that's not the issue. What they're really saying to their voters is the Democrats may undo our packing.
Over 13 million absentee ballots have already been returned from more than 50 million requests, according to the United States Elections Project. But in 10 battleground states, first-class mail delivery time is down nearly 8% after Trump administration operational changes first ordered this summer, then rescinded. Some changes can't be reversed in time, like mail sorting machines that were dismantled. That uncertainty is especially concerning for states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Georgia, which don't accept ballots received after Election Day.
Protecting the post office is key to making sure our voting system works.
Sylvia Albert with Common Cause says we can't make voters have to choose between their health and right to vote. Recent polls show government response to the coronavirus at record low approval. Comparing Trump's senior support in 2016 to now, AARP's John Hishta notes Trump led people 65 plus then by close to 10%. Recent polls show Biden has a narrow lead now among older voters.
I do think it's a direct result of their nervousness around the COVID pandemic, as well as their own health and things like that.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks to Laura Rosbrow-Tellum, and thanks for listening.
Rural hospitals and communities depend on the Affordable Care Act, and hundreds of thousands of people in those communities would lose health coverage if the ACA was repealed. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the story.
On November 10th, the U.S. Supreme Court hears oral arguments in a case that will likely decide the fate of the Affordable Care Act. Texas and more than a dozen other states are asking the court to repeal the 2010 law that overturned the private health insurance market and expanded Medicaid. ACA opponents believe the so-called individual mandate, requiring people to have health insurance, is unconstitutional. But April Rain of the advocacy group Healthcare Voter says the ACA also put patient protections in place, including banning insurance companies from setting lifetime dollar limits on benefits.
for those people who have chronic issues, for those people who need surgeries that were unexpected, that could be debilitating and lead to bankruptcy.
More than 360,000 Arkansans could lose health coverage if the ACA is repealed, according to the Economic Policy Institute. However, experts say that number would likely be higher since the pandemic because more people have lost jobs and employer-based coverage. The ACA also bars insurance companies from discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions. Research from the Kaiser Family Foundation finds nationwide 130 million people could be denied coverage if that protection ends. And Rain points out that figure could grow.
And let's remember, that's not including the over 8 million people who now are survivors of the coronavirus.
And the survival of many rural hospitals hinges on the ACA, Rain says. According to an Urban Institute report, hospitals in Arkansas could lose $836 million in revenue without Medicaid expansion. It's estimated that hospitals' uncompensated care costs have fallen by 57% in Arkansas since the law took effect.
Part of the issue here is that the Republicans have said that they're going to repeal and replace, but we have yet to see what they're going to replace it with. And that's the scary part, because we don't know what we don't know.
Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson has consistently supported Arkansas's Medicaid expansion under the ACA, which currently covers an estimated 250,000 people. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
It's been known for a while that President Donald Trump pays less in income tax than most middle-class Americans, but a New York Times report now shows that in some years he actually did pay taxes in China. A previously unreported bank account in China controlled by Trump International Hotels Management paid $188,561 in taxes in China between 2013 and 2015 in connection with potential licensing deals there. Earlier Times reporting showed that Trump paid no U.S. taxes for several years and just $750 in 2016 and 2017. Two earlier Trump projects in China were never completed, one because of a corruption investigation of the Chinese government agency that Trump was working through. In his campaign, Trump has accused Joe Biden of being, quote, weak on China, and accused the Biden family of, quote, selling out our country to China. A new documentary that premiered yesterday in Rome captured Pope Francis expressing strong support for same-sex civil marriages. In the documentary, Pope Francis says, quote, homosexual people have a right to be in a family. They are children of God and have a right to a family. Nobody should be thrown out or made miserable over it. This is his first public backing as Pope of civil unions for same-sex couples, though he had endorsed such legal arrangements when he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires. Since becoming Pope in March 2013, Francis has adopted a more inclusive tone towards LGBTQ people in his public statements, including the issue of gay priests. Pope Francis's conservative opponents have been angered by statements they regard as attempting to shift the church toward progressive values, with some even accusing him of heresy. The new film is called Francesco. It's by Russian-born director Yevgeny Afanasyev. It also focuses on other issues the Pope has spoken up for, including the environment, poverty, migration, and inequality. A Minnesota family saves energy through simple living powered by wood, wind, and the sun. Dr. Anthony Leiswitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiswitz, and this is Climate Connections. About two decades ago, natural gas production in the U.S. began to boom, largely because of the growth of fracking, a technique for extracting large volumes of gas from deep underground. Burning natural gas produces less carbon pollution and releases fewer harmful particles to the air than burning coal. But Barbara Gottlieb of the nonprofit Physicians for Social Responsibility says fracking is not without its own consequences for human health. She says the process can emit toxic pollution, such as benzene and formaldehyde, into water and the air. And there's a growing body of research associating active fracking sites with a range of symptoms, from headaches to premature births.
That's how extreme these problems are, and they're terribly worrisome for health professionals.
She says the natural gas industry also contributes to health risks far beyond a fracking site.
Methane leaks from the wells, it leaks from the pipelines and the compressor stations.
Methane, a potent greenhouse gas, contributes to global warming and the health risks it causes, from heat-related illness to injuries and even death during extreme storms and flooding. So Physicians for Social Responsibility has called for a ban on fracking and a rapid transition to clean energy instead. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, your stories, and your tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Hendrik Brokelshin, Samantha Law, Don Merrill, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Megan Kamrick, Anthony Lizowitz, and Nadia Romlagon. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Juneteenth Radio, bringing you the latest stories in African American and Black society. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, we'll hear Between the Covers, bringing interviews with authors from across the country. And at 11:30, it's Words with Pictures, featuring an interview with comics creator Ali Brosh. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, featuring an interview with Republican Secretary of State candidate Kim Thatcher.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community. I'm Don Merrill, and I'm talking with Kim Thatcher. Ms. Thatcher is running for Oregon Secretary of State. Ms. Thatcher, welcome.
Thank you.
Ms. Thatcher, I interviewed you in 2014. At that time, you represented House District 25, but you were running for the seat you currently hold, which is Senate District 13. Then I asked you why you wanted to move from the House to the Senate, and you said that was a good question. So 6 years later, I want to ask you, why do you want to move out of the legislature and into the Secretary of State?
That is where most of my focus has been during my 16 years in the legislature, has been dealing directly with topics and commissions and committees and all that that deal with the Secretary of State's office. I have worked on the on the Legislative Audits Committee longer than anybody there. I've worked on the business issues that, especially getting the Small Business Advocate in place and advocating for that in 2011. And I've dealt with elections issues. That's been a topic that I've worked helping with. Securing our election, making sure we have a people-driven process, which has been kind of tricky because it seems like the legislature wants to whittle away at that and erode that right, the initiative and referendum process. And so it just makes sense for me, especially as a business owner that has run some pretty big projects and lots of moving parts and people that will translate well to running the Secretary of State's office. And also being able to run the corporation division and knowing what businesses are going through today.
You know, I'm curious about something. In Oregon's history, secretaries of state have become governor. The most recent example is our current governor, of course, Kate Brown, who was Secretary of State, and then Mr. Richardson, who became Secretary of State after running for governor but then losing to John Kitzhaber. Do you want to be Oregon's governor eventually?
I am not looking to be Oregon's governor. I could only find three situations in Oregon history where a Secretary of State stopped being a Secretary of State and succeeded to the office of governor, and that was the most recent one being, of course, our current governor. But I'm prepared to be so if this rare combination of events happens, but that is not why I'm running for Secretary of State. I'm not looking to use it as a stepping stone to a higher office. I really would like to just serve as Secretary of State, and that is what I'm very much prepared to and equipped to do, and that's what I look forward to serving in.
When I interviewed former Secretary of State Richardson, I interviewed him twice, and he told me that although he was Republican, to some extent he felt like he was breaking with his party, in that he wanted to execute the office in a nonpartisan way, not only in letter but in spirit. Other Republicans felt his achievement to Secretary of State was an opportunity to work toward turning the state redder. And so that makes me ask, how would you be different from your opponent, Shamia Fagan? The Secretary of State is an elected position, but as I mentioned, Mr. Richardson strived to treat it in a nonpartisan way. So what would you do differently in the way you would lead the office over the way your opponent might lead the office?
I admired the way Secretary of State Dennis Richardson handled this office and dealt with this office. He looked at it, and I also look at it, as mostly a managerial type of a position with what should be nonpartisan responsibilities. And I absolutely agree that is how the Secretary of State's office should be run. My opponent has Democrat for Secretary of State on her sign. She has mentioned in forums before that she thinks Oregon needs to have a Democrat Secretary of State in there. I just don't see this as, I am looking at using an independent commission for redistricting, honoring much of what was in Initiative Petition 57 that was not able to make it to the ballot due to the difficulties with COVID and all that. But there were a number of proposals, or a number of people, a wide breadth and spectrum of political views that were supporting this concept, everywhere from NAACP and the Taxpayer Association of Oregon, the League of Women Voters, and many others that were supporting the independent commission. I have said all along that I would support using that type of a commission in redistricting. I am not looking to sit with, a handpicked group of people to look like it's going through a nonpartisan process when really it just, is not. It is somebody that wants to put their thumb on the scale as far as how our just districts are drawn. I think that is a big difference between me and my opponent.
I've been watching ads from your opponent campaign committee, and I see that one promotes her and then one attacks you, but I've yet to see any type of ad from your campaign. You're a seasoned politician, and Ms. Fagan's ads have been running for weeks, and the election is a month away. Where are your campaign ads on television?
They are playing. I have a couple of different ads out right now. I don't have quite the war chest of money that she does with the handful of six-digit donors, but I do have ads running, and they are mostly in the Portland area right now, I believe. I don't know where all they're playing. I don't make the ad buys, but we do have a couple of ads running.
So much of what what's happening now relates to our 2014 conversation. Back then, you called the session where the legislature was split evenly down the middle by party. You called that a fun session. But in conversations I've had with candidates this year as part of a candidate interview project I've been running, Democrats say they can't get anything done because Republicans are being obstructionists, while Republicans say Democrats and their supermajority mutes a lot of their concerns and they get steamrolled, which is why they walk out of session. The last few sessions seem to be anything but fun. What's that been like for you, and will you miss the lawmaking part if you become Secretary of State?
I absolutely agree with many of the sentiments expressed that it has not been fun. Not fun at all. In fact, had voters been able to be given a chance to have their voices heard on some of these bills that they just wanted to block from them having a voice, You would not have seen the walkouts that you saw. You would not have seen the denial of quorum. You would have seen probably some bipartisan bill passing, you know, lawmaking. But there just was a concerted effort to try to block voters from their right to a referendum. They were being blocked from being able to call the question on legislative action and put it to a vote of the people. They were being blocked from getting information on even how much something like, you know, the cap and trade, for instance, was going to cost. So it was just kind of financial malpractice combined with blocking voters from being able to weigh in, and the ability of even able to look into the program once it passed. There was just, you know, a lot of non-transparency built into the bill where things would be hidden. There were situations where, well, I just really disagreed with the fact that they were blocking voters from being able to have their voices heard through the referendum.
Then in what way do you feel it was being interfered with?
Well, the referendum process is interfered with when the when an emergency clause is added, and it's added for just for the reason to block people from weighing in, because it was a big question. It was going to be affecting a lot of people. It was going to be affecting the whole state, every man, woman, and child, every business, every your cost of living. Everything was going to be going up, and everything was going to be effective. Yet they put in an emergency clause to essentially make it so that it was passed upon signing by the governor, and that would have precluded the ability of voters to put it on the ballot through a referendum.
And just quickly, could you explain why the emergency clause has been a significant point of discussion and frustration for Republicans in the legislature?
Well, the emergency clause has been used for no other reason but to block voters from, referring what the legislature did to the ballot and calling the question, saying, hey, we don't agree with this as voters. Let's put it on the ballot and let's have a statewide vote on it. That has been blocked when they put the emergency clause on it. And there are a lot of bills that have an emergency clause on it where there's no problem. It's bipartisan. It is something pressing. It needs to pass before it lapses, or there's a good reason for putting on an emergency clause. But there has been abuse of that, and that's what has been happening lately with the emergency clause, to purposely block voters from a referendum.
When I talked with other Secretary of States in 2016, I wasn't surprised that election officials defended their voting systems and procedures. But considering everything that's been happening since then, do you think that they have more reason, and would you as a Secretary of State feel there's more reason to defend them now? Like in Oregon, for instance, is everything working the way you'd want it to if you had the job, or if you could make changes, what would they be? Because I'm assuming you've been following the operation of the Secretary of State, and you have thoughts about what you would do if you became Secretary of State.
Well, I would like to look at the election system from top to bottom, from registering to vote, clear to certifying the election, making sure that we do have the best processes in place, that we have we don't have any gaps where people who may not intend, who have no good intention, we can manipulate things or expose a weakness. I want to make sure that we don't have those weaknesses. I want to look at, so whatever that reveals, whatever that sort of review shows, is what I would like to change. But I would also like to change the ORSTAR, which is Oregon's campaign contribution and expenditure reporting. It is very difficult to use, I think. It is not real user-friendly. It's difficult to follow the money. I think that would be something that we can improve and help help people follow the elections a little bit better. I would like to be able to get a more of an online, a way of having some more voter engagement online. And I would also like to look at postmarks to accept those when, like Washington, up through Election Day, if a ballot has been put in the mail and it's postmarked by that, you know, by that day, then it should count. There are people in Oregon, or excuse me, county clerks in Oregon who would be more comfortable with allowing postmarks to count through the Saturday before the Election Day. And that's fine too. But just making sure that people also have the knowledge on how to get a ballot when they've been displaced. With the wildfires and thousands of mailboxes having been burned down, plus hundreds of miles of roads having been shut down, most of them are opening up, but still it's causing people to have to go out of their way to get places. And these people who have been displaced by wildfires don't necessarily know where they're going to be in order to change their address with the Secretary of State's office or the county clerk's office before October 13th. So there's that, and I think we should be allowing for better access to in-person voting opportunities for these people who have been displaced by wildfires, and also to get the information out in a more robust way so that they know how to get their ballot.
And this is my last question. Why should Oregonians vote for you for Secretary of State?
Well, I have the good combination of experience in both the public and the private sector, and all of it can relate to the Secretary of State's office. I've been working on these issues for a long, long time, and that would include being on the Public Records Advisory Council, trying to help make access to our public records easier. And I'm on the Transparency Commission, something I helped create back in 2009, reaching across the aisle and passing a bill to put our state checkbook online. And, you know, as a Republican, I know, and I'm very practiced with working across the aisle with other people and trying to get consensus on issues. So that's been a necessary skill to have as a Republican to get anything done in the state. That's what you have to do. I've been in the legislature 16 years. My opponent's only been in for 6. I've been a business owner for 28 years with many employees, and I don't think my opponent has that experience. So I've weathered economic storms in both the legislature and haven't had to make hard policy decisions and budget cuts and, you know, all kinds of things like that. I am looking at it as a nonpartisan race, in that the Secretary of State has nonpartisan duties, and I commit to doing that. I commit to utilizing an independent commission for redistricting. I'm not just going to be sitting in a closet turning the state the color I want with a Sharpie.
I just want to touch on something you said. Do you think that you had said you're not going to be